In December of 1988, a bomb brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. It killed all of the people on board the plane and 11 people who were there on the ground. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an expert in international law who was involved in the first lawsuit brought against Libya on behalf of the victims of this terrorist act. He also helped write a law that makes it possible for individuals to hold foreign governments accountable for acts of terrorism. Our guest this morning is Alan Gerson. He is currently research professor of international relations at George Washington University, and he is an authority in the area of international law. He is the co-author of a newly published book that explores this subject. The title of his book is The Price of Terror, Lessons of Lockerbie for a World on the Brink. HarperCollins is the publisher of the book. It's out now. He's joining us by telephone, and as we talk, your questions and comments certainly are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, that's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Gerson, hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Before we get into the story, maybe perhaps I'll just start by asking how it is that you became involved in this personally, because not only are you the author of this book, Price of Terror, you're also in it. That is, you're one of the people who are, sure, and your story is in it. How is it that you personally became involved?
Well, I literally got my job through the New York Times. I published an op-ed piece in the New York Times on July 2nd of 1992, in which I said that it is a mistake for the families of the victims of Pan Am 103 to focus exclusively on the responsibility of Pan American Airways for that disaster, that there are new ways in international law which enable them to focus on the state that was responsible for the murder of their loved ones. And that state was Libya. So I published that. I was a lawyer, but I was also an academic, and I did so really in my academic capacity. That article was reproduced in the International Herald Tribune, and a man named Bruce Smith, who had lost his wife, Ingrid, on Pan Am 103, read it and called me and said, "This is exactly what I have been saying. We have to find ways to go after the perpetrator and not be distracted by going after the airlines."
The soon after the plane blew up and crashed, investigators got there. They got to go over the wreckage, something no doubt that the bombers didn't intend.
It's uncertain what they intend.
Well, I guess that's an open question. One, you would think that perhaps from their viewpoint, it would have been better to have this occur over the Atlantic Ocean so that there wouldn't be any wreckage.
People would not have known who the perpetrator was. Now, they may have wanted to leave their mark.
I suppose one could argue either way, and you don't really know which is the correct way.
Yeah, we in the book itself, we say that it is likely, against the popular theory, that they really meant for the bomb to go off before the plane went over the Atlantic Ocean.
The investigators, they got there, and apparently also very quickly after going through the wreckage and taking a look at it for a couple of days, the conclusion was what perhaps they suspected right from the beginning anyway, that it was indeed a bomb, that it was in the luggage compartment, it was in a suitcase, and it was pretty clear that that's really what it was.
That's correct.
How did they? Well, let's maybe first talk about the issue of who the immediate suspects were, because Libya certainly was one of them, but also Iran and Syria were considered as possible suspects, and certainly for the Iranians, there was motive, because the United States had accidentally shot down an Iranian jetliner. And that was one of the possible scenarios, that this was somehow engineered by Iran as a revenge, and in fact, for the United States having done that. How is it that, though, we ended up settling on that this was ultimately the Libyan government that was behind this?
Well, initially, what the investigators went on in determining motive was, as you point out, revenge. But they had something more to go on than simply trying to figure out who might have revenge in mind. Just a little over a month before the bombing of Pan Am 103, the German police had broken up a cell in Hamburg where they discovered that radical Palestinians, through the working under the aegis of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, and with the support of Iran and perhaps Syria, had been plotting to blow up an airplane. And they had Toshiba radios similar to the kind that were used as the vehicle for the planting of the bomb on Pan Am 103. They had the timetables. They had everything else. And these individuals had been arrested by the German police. And as we document in the book, under pressure from Iran, all of those individuals except one were released. So the immediate focus of attention was on Iran, not only because they had a motive, as you point out, because of the shooting down accidentally by the United States of an Iranian Airbus, which killed 290 people, but also because the German police had actually broken up a cell with direct connections to Iran.
Mm-hmm. I think that there are some people who continue to maintain that is the explanation of what happened. There is a book that I'm not sure if it's been published yet or if it's just coming that was written by a couple of British journalists in which they make the argument that, in fact, that it was done by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine as revenge, done on at the request of Iran as revenge, and they outline this plot. And in fact, you make reference to it in the book about that involves the CIA and drug smuggling and so forth. And so their contention is that the two Libyans who were put on trial, and one of them was convicted, were not responsible for this. I don't know. I think you're probably familiar with this argument, if not
sure.
with this book.
Sure.
What's your thought about that? You think that's simply not correct?
Well, our research in the book led us to believe, and we indicated as such, that the initial plan for the bombing took place in Syria, and that the agents of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command were then dispatched into the Bekaa Valley, controlled fully by Syria, to meet with members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And there, the plot to blow up an American airliner, because it was an American airliner, was hatched. Now, after Operation Autumn Leaves, which I mentioned earlier, occurred, that foiled the hijackers' initial efforts, and the plot was then handed over to Libya. We discuss at length in the book as to whether or not the intelligence agencies of the U.S. government and Britain were as assiduous in going after leads that might point to Syrian and Iranian involvement as they were in following up leads that might point to Libya's involvement. And our conclusion, based on interviews, and we provide the names of the retired intelligence agents that we interviewed, is that, in fact, agents were told that it might be better if they really focused their efforts at one particular point on Libya and not on Syria and Iran, because geopolitical considerations made the prospect of actually doing anything against Syria and Iran, if they were found to have been involved, something very difficult to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly when you look at the three countries and the relationship between the United States and these countries, it's plausible to think that any one of them could have been responsible. What was the thinking of the motivation of if indeed this was Libya, why it is that Libya did this?
Oh, well, First, there was evidence, that clear evidence that pointed to Libya. I have no doubt that the individual that was found guilty at the trial that was concluded this last year in Holland was, in fact, guilty. That's Megrahi. And that the other person who was acquitted was also guilty, although there was not enough proof that could be mustered to meet the very high standard of proof required for a criminal conviction. In terms of motivation, in 1986, throughout 1985, there had been skirmishes between the United States and Libyan forces, although no American was killed. But then the Libyans bombed, and now I can say it definitively, and not a speculation, because a court proceeding in Berlin concluded just a few months ago and found that, in fact, four Libyan agents were responsible for the bombing of a discotheque in Berlin called La Belle in 1986. It was a discotheque frequented by American servicemen, and two American soldiers were killed. The response to that bombing, when the United States discovered through intercepts that it was Libya that was responsible, was for the dispatch of 16 F-111 jets to bomb Libyan targets in Benghazi and Tripoli. Only two of them were able to get through because of bad weather conditions at the time, but 40 to 60 civilians, Libyan civilians, were killed. The leader, as Muammar Gaddafi is called, was not killed, but President Reagan said at the time that he would not have lost any sleep if he had been killed. His stepdaughter was, however, killed. So clearly those events set in motion the possibility of a revenge killing against the United States. Now, what occurred after the bombing, the U.S. bombing of Libya in 1986, was a series of statements by the president and especially his Secretary of State, George Shultz, which indicated that Gaddafi had been put in his box, that terrorism had now been contained from Libya, that Libya was no longer a threat. And yet at the very same time, as we document in our book, the State Department was issuing releases to its various offices around the world, which demonstrated that the Libyan intelligence had been ordered to target American installations, including American civilians. And according to the indictments later filed in the U.S. District Court by the Justice Department, it was shortly after 1986 that the Libyans began to plan for the bombing of Pan Am 103, which occurred in December of 1988.
This may be too complex a question for a show like this, and maybe slightly off the point of the book, but how is it that, given the fact that here the plane exploded in flight and crashed, that the investigators were actually able not only just to say this was a bomb and that it was in, we expect that it was in a piece of luggage, but that they could make the analysis down to the brand of luggage, the fact that it was in a cassette player, the brand of cassette player, and how is it possible that they can come up by going over what I'm sure is a very difficult sort of crash scene, that they can come up with that kind of evidence and say with that certainty all of these fine details?
Well, it's testimony to the remarkable forensic and investigative skills of the FBI and the CIA and the British counterparts. What they did is they scanned over 100 miles of green fields outside of Lockerbie for any clues, and in that entire area, they were able to find this tiny chip from a circuit board. They were able to trace that circuit board to a Swiss manufacturer, Botelier, who had manufactured a timing device that could be used to set off bombs based on altitude. And it had been expressly or tailor-made for Libya. It had been on special order. So they were able to track that. And then secondly, they were able to find that there was a shirt. There, the bomb was wrapped, around with a number of shirts, and they were able to somehow find the label, although it was terribly charred, and then track that down to a store in Malta. And they interviewed the shop owner, and the shop owner was able to then make photo identifications of individuals who had come in to quickly purchase shirts. And the photo spread that had been shown the shop owner included pictures of the two Libyan intelligence agents that had been put on trial, and that shop owner was able to successfully identify those individuals. So this makes up part of the body of evidence that was used to demonstrate that Libya was, in fact, responsible.
Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Alan Gerson. He is currently a research professor of international relations at George Washington University, his area of expertise, international law. He is the co-author of this book that we're talking about, The Price of Terror, The Lessons of Lockerbie for a World on the Brink. That's the subtitle. It's published by HarperCollins, and it is indeed about the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. It was destroyed in flight by bomb in December of 1988. It crashed over Lockerbie, Scotland. All the people on the plane were killed, also a number of people on the ground. And he was involved in a lawsuit against Libya on behalf of some victims of the crash. He also was involved in helping to write and lobby for a law that made it possible for individuals to actually hold governments, foreign governments, accountable for acts of terrorism like this. And your questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things in the book that you explain is that sometime before this took place, there was a threat. Early in December of that same year, there was a warning about the planned bombing of an airliner. Now, the particulars were different, but it was indeed a warning that the United States government knew about. And one of the questions that you raise, and I'm sure that is in many people's minds, is if the United States had taken that warning more seriously, could this event have been prevented?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint it to this particular warning, which is called the Helsinki warning, because it had come about through a materials that had come to the attention of authorities in Helsinki. The fact is that there were six highly placed intelligence agents who had come onto the airplane. And presumably, if the government really knew that there was going to be a bomb on board, those intelligence operatives would have been warned and they would not have lost their lives. But you raise a larger, more general question, which is, could the government have taken steps to have prevented the bombing of the Pan Am 103, just as we now ask ourselves whether the United States government could have taken steps to prevent the bombing that occurred on September 11th? And I believe the answer is clearly yes. We did not take adequate measures then, and we did not take adequate measures before September 11th to ensure that there would be airline security, measures which were within our grasp. And we certainly did not form an effective policy to deal with terrorism either before the bombing of Pan Am 103 or the bombing of the World Trade Center and Pentagon on September 11th.
Mm. One of the also there's another set of questions raised about Pan Am and their security before this took place, and how it is that that the bag that had the bomb managed to get on the plane without a corresponding passenger on the plane. Can one fault, or how much should one fault Pan Am and their security arrangements for the fact that that the bomb got on the plane?
Well, Pan Am was faulted and found to have acted not only negligently, because if an airline acts negligently and you lose your life, the most you can recover under international law today, still called the Warsaw Convention, is $75,000. But if you find that the airline went beyond ordinary negligence and was guilty of willful misconduct, that is to say, there was not only the equivalent of a banana peel on the floor and someone slipped, but it continued to leave that banana peel on the floor after many people slipped, then it's guilty of willful misconduct. It can be guilty of willful misconduct, and in fact, Pan Am was found to have been guilty of willful misconduct, and it was required to pay $500 million in damages to the families of the victims. But the client that I represented initially, then Moore joined the suit, was Bruce Smith, the former Pan Am airline pilot himself, and he continually argued that it is a terrible distraction to focus all of our energies on the airline, because whatever its faults, whether it was simply negligent or worse than simply negligent and actually guilty of willful misconduct, it certainly was not the murderer. It certainly didn't plan the operation. It didn't plant the bomb, and we have to look to others. Now, what Pan Am failed to do specifically was it did fail to follow FAA regulations, which had been then newly installed, that required every passenger to identify his baggage before that baggage was loaded. Today, that's a requirement, but you will not get much comfort to realize that it's only a requirement on international flights. And in fact, after the bombing of Pan Am 103, we have taken, as a government, steps to ensure that that would not recur, but only by way of a bomb being placed on an airline which is coming into the United States. But if you are flying from Chicago to Tulsa or to Oklahoma City or anywhere else within the United States, the chances are better than 90% that your baggage, as of today, will not be, that is to say your checked-in baggage, will not be properly x-rayed to determine whether or not there are explosives on board. Mm.
See, that's something that came as a surprise to me. I guess I had thought that in all cases, the airlines made sure that if there was a bag on the plane, there was also a person with that bag, and that was the case for all flights, including domestic flights. And I guess I was surprised to learn that, in fact, that that's not the case.
To the best of my knowledge, that has not yet been instituted, but I can say with certainty that the screening of baggage for explosives still has not been instituted. The new president's mandate requires that the airlines provide a plan for the x-raying or otherwise screening of checked-in baggage, which is to be fully implemented by the end of 2002, if we live so long.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. I want to do that, and the caller's in Champaign County on our line number one.
Hi.
Yes.
Good morning. You haven't discussed the law that you said you had something to do with, and I'm wondering what the scope of that law is. The U.S. won't join an international court, and we have a lot of potential, I think, indictees of different stripes around the world. We have the example of Belgium going after Ariel Sharon now. What is the actual substance of your law, if you could condense that a little bit?
Sure. Well, what you refer to, the international court, deals with a criminal prosecution. And the law that we helped pass, that is to say the Pan Am 103 families...
Alien tort, is that?
No.
No.
The law that the Pan Am 103 families, working in coordination with the victims of the Oklahoma bombing families, helped pass was called the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And this provides an alternative to simply pursuing terrorists through the means of criminal indictments. This allows for civil actions for damages by the families of the victims against certain states that are accused of having engaged in or sponsored terrorism. And these states are states that are determined by the State Department to have engaged in such activities over a period of time.
So this is a civil action, and it's, it seems to me that it's a result of the fact that the U.S. won't join an international court. that some of these things ought to be adjudicated criminally. And we're always pointing the figure outside the country. I think there are people like Henry Kissinger, who's dodging subpoenas in Paris, who ought to be called to account for him. I mean, the family of Renee Schneider could sue him for loss, too, I think, because he had something very closely to do with that case, that guy's assassination in Chile.
So, well, I think it's based on the recognition that the criminal court system is not a very good one in and of itself for yielding results, that it's very, very hard to get a conviction, even in the best of circumstances, through the criminal justice system. We know the experience of the O.J. Simpson case in the United States, which teaches us, I believe, that defendants are given, and properly so, every benefit of the doubt, and therefore it is extremely difficult because you have to have about 95% certainty beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you apply that test to individuals accused of international crimes and people who are abroad and where the evidence is abroad, it's exceedingly difficult to get a conviction. And it's in that context that the families decided that there had to be another tool at our disposal. And the tool that they were able to forge after a very long battle was the tool of a civil action so that ordinary citizens could be empowered.
That was an omnibus bill that had a lot of stuff that you might even disagree with,
the
effective death penalty.
Sure.
Well, it is hard to get an international court to decide something, but there was one instance in the 80s where it did happen, and that was the case of Nicaragua versus the U.S., but the U.S. just denied its jurisdiction. So, I mean, there's like a $16 billion settlement for the Contra War, but that isn't even brought up in terms of talking about who the terrorists are in these days. But anyway, I'll let you continue with the discussion at hand. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other callers are certainly welcome. You have questions, comments, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. Again, our guest, Alan Gerson. He is research professor of international relations at George Washington University, and he is also the co-author of the book, The Price of Terror. It is about the bombing of Pan Am 103, and it is published by HarperCollins. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-WILO. Well, perhaps you can talk a little bit more about how it is that you managed to get this law passed that would allow individuals to essentially go to court against another government, something that before that this law came along, that it wasn't an option.
Well, we managed to get it passed, but with enormous, enormous difficulty, because I initially went into court in the U.S. District Court on behalf of Bruce Smith, who alone among the Pan Am families decided that we should try to find a way of holding a foreign government accountable. And I was essentially laughed at or dismissed by many lawyers who argued that, don't you know you can't do that? Foreign governments are protected by the doctrine of sovereign immunity, which is, like the term implies, something out of the 19th century, that a government is sovereign, responsible to no one other than itself, obligated to no one else, and certainly not to its citizens. Well, we argued that the doctrine may continue to exist, and it's found in black-letter U.S. law. But certainly, the drafters of that law could not have intended for a foreign government to deliberately murder American citizens and then go into court and hide behind the skirt of sovereign immunity, that it was implicit that if you bomb an airplane, you forfeit your right to that privilege. We thought that might be a winning argument. Unfortunately, when we began to make that argument, the government of Libya was joined by the government of the United States, whose lawyers, and these are my former colleagues at the Justice Department, came in on Libya's side to defend the doctrine of sovereign immunity. And they filed briefs in the U.S. District Court, Court of Appeals, and the United States Supreme Court in opposition to our efforts to say that the doctrine of sovereign immunity was not applicable. They sought to make sure that it was applicable because, you know, even the United States government cannot be sued unless there is a specific exception in the law. And unfortunately, as a result of that intervention, and because we could not get the judges to be a little bit more innovative, we lost. And we were really at the end of our game when we had the terrible bombing in Oklahoma in 1995, in April of 1995, of the Alfred Murrah office building. And as a result of that bombing, there was renewed increase within the United States Congress and elsewhere for passage of an anti-terrorism law. And although the Oklahoma bombing concerned something domestic and domestic terrorism, there emerged, because so many of the Pan Am, especially one person of the Pan Am families went out and provided tremendous emotional help and sustenance to the families of the Oklahoma bombing, there then came about a political union whereby the families of Pan Am 103 were prepared to help the families of Oklahoma get what they wanted, which was the effective death penalty, so that there would not be endless habeas corpus appeals and that the average person sentenced to death would be able to be on death row for an average of 15 years nationally. And in return, the Oklahoma families joined the Pan Am families in urging Congress to adopt legislation which would amend the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act to permit lawsuits against terrorist states. And as a result, the families were able to overcome the difficulties that they had in the courtroom by having new legislation emerge, and that legislation was called the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. But even after it emerged, we had to face a battle that lasted about 2 years with Libya, arguing not on the basis of international law, but now on the basis of U.S. constitutional law, that the law itself was unconstitutional. Fortunately, this time we had the benefit of having the United States State Department and Justice Department come in on our side, and the validity of that law was finally upheld, which brings us to our current situation where we are now in pretrial discovery and hope to go to trial in the early part of next year.
Hmm. How long would you expect overall that it take for this case to be heard?
Oh, it shouldn't take more than a couple of months or so.
Hmm. So you would think that there would be sometime next year that there would be at least an initial result.
Right.
And then also, I would assume the possibility of appeals.
Yes,
after that.
The possibility of appeals, and then there's, of course, the potential difficulties in collecting a judgment once you have a judgment.
Hmm. Do you expect that, given the fact that now that this avenue is open to people, that there would be some individuals who lost family members on September 11th that would attempt to bring civil action? I suppose there the question is against whom?
Well, they have two problems in bringing a civil action. The first is, as you point out, against whom, and that remains to be determined. And there are certain difficulties in that, which I can get into. But the second layer of problems is that they are essentially being offered in a very lucrative way the prospect of immediate compensation if they waive their rights to go after either the airlines or any other body, entity, government, that may have been responsible for the September 11th bombings. So we don't even get to that question for the September 11th families if they sign that waiver, and most of them, I would imagine, due to the press of financial circumstances and the enormous difficulty that they will have in finding out who was actually accountable in going after that person or entity. So we don't even get to that second question, but I believe there will be among the September 11th families those who, when faced with the choice of either obtaining immediate financial relief but not with the benefit of having the perpetrators pay, but rather the United States government, or opting to not take immediate relief but to pursue the long route that many of the families in Pan Am 103 undertook, which is to really try to hold the perpetrators directly accountable. I suspect that many of the September 11th families may also decide to choose that route.
Mm-hmm. Well, do for the people who lost family members on who were on Pan Am 103, is there those who have decided to pursue this? Is it for them mostly a matter of principle? That is, they want some justice, at least in the sense that the person or persons who will be responsible will be publicly identified as such, or are they actually thinking that there might, at the end of the line, might be some kind of compensation?
The principal motivation is accountability.
Yeah.
It's to have a trial where all of the facts can be shown to the public. And you have to remember that the civil action was instituted long before this criminal action ever occurred. And at that time, what the family saw was, one, there was really no prospect of any military action against Libya, and two, it seemed highly unlikely that the individuals were ever going to be released by Libya to stand trial, and three, even if they were released to stand trial, it didn't really, in the final analysis, matter all that much, because these were low to mid-level operatives. They were not the kingpins, the masterminds, which was the ruler of that country, and there would be no compensation to be paid. But compensation has a larger goal. It's not merely to compensate, it's actually to deter. And therefore, the damage component has two aspects. One is compensatory damages, and the second is punitive damages. And the larger component is the component that deals with punitive damages. And the aim here is to deter further act of terrorism by making the sponsors, the state sponsors of terrorism, and I emphasize state sponsors because what the families of Pan Am 103 came to believe with enormous conviction was that what makes contemporary terrorism possible on a large scale like Pan Am 103 or September 11th is the fact that it is state-sponsored. And therefore, one way of preventing or deterring further acts of state sponsorship is to making the states pay a hefty price for their crimes.
We have another caller to bring into the conversation. This is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hello. There have been an awful lot of questions raised about the process that went on in the Netherlands that identified or that convicted these Libyans, most of it not in the American papers, but the British press, for example, is full of articles saying that basically it was a kangaroo court. And the report that the Security Council asked for, the Secretary General nominated a special observer, and he produced a report on it last spring that's never seen the light of day, that apparently the U.S. and U.K. got suppressed when it came out. Do you know anything about that report, and what about the suggestion that the whole process in The Hague was pretty much a put-up job?
It wasn't in The Hague. It was in a special camp called Camp Zeist,
okay. Sure.
Which was undertaken under Scottish law. You had three, not one judge, but three of the top Scottish judges, and to believe that this thing was a kangaroo court would be to indict the Anglo-British system of justice and the Scottish judges.
That's pretty easy to do after those last couple of weeks, isn't it? Indict the Anglo-American system of justice? I mean, drumhead courts and whatnot?
I don't think so. I think that my review, and this is all public information of what was done, and it's a complete transcript, shows that they were scrupulous in looking at the evidence. Now, there is an appeals process, and it's underway right now. Professor Alan Dershowitz of the Harvard Law School and participated in the O.J. Simpson case, has now joined.
In favor of torture a couple of weeks ago, right?
I'm sorry, can I finish my sentence? Has now joined the Libyan defense team. So you have an appeal, and I will wait and see what occurs. I myself am satisfied that the courts acted properly. As a matter of fact, I believe that there were grounds for the conviction of the second individual who was acquitted.
Why was the Secretary General's report on the Lockerbie trial in the Netherlands, or the report prepared for the Secretary General, not released?
I don't know about that.
You know about the report? Were you familiar with it? Have you heard of the report at all?
I heard that there was a report, but I don't know what the stage is or why it wasn't released, and I'm not aware of its contents.
Well, since it was suppressed, I guess nobody's aware of its contents. Well, it seems to me that the that's sort of a bad sign right there, precisely since that was the oversight that the Security Council called for, and the negative comment on the trial itself, which, as I say, was fairly common in the European papers, seems not to have got this far. But perhaps some of that will turn up in the appeal process.
Well, okay. Any further, Professor Gerson? You want to?
We're waiting for an appeals process. I mean, I mean, the caller doesn't have, as much faith as I do in the ability of the courts of England to provide impartial justice. But I think one looks. I don't know what else one can do. One has a transcript. It's transparent. One can review the record. It's all transparent. It's on appeal. Whatever the Secretary General's report is, I'm sure that will also be released. But this is a public trial. There's nothing hidden. There is an appeal process. People are free to, to form their own conclusions. But I think we're operating under the rule of law.
We have just about 6 minutes left on the program. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Alan Gerson. He is research professor of international relations at George Washington University. And he is also the co-author, along with Jerry Adler, who is a senior editor at Newsweek. They're the co-authors of this book that we've mentioned. It's titled The Price of Terror, Lessons of Lockerbie for a World on the Brink. It is published by HarperCollins. And it deals with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. In December of 1988, came down over Lockerbie, Scotland. All of the people on the plane were killed, also some people on the ground. And our guest, Professor Gerson's involvement was that he worked as an attorney and brought a suit against Libya on behalf of some of the victims, and also was involved in writing law that made it possible for individuals to hold foreign governments accountable for acts of terrorism. We do have time for perhaps one or two more calls. If somebody calls real quick, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Certainly the United States government has comes in for criticism in the book, in part, as you mentioned, because initially they actually took the side of Libya and in defending the idea of national sovereignty, obviously because the United States didn't want to be the subject of lawsuits. It seems that in other ways that when one asks how did the United States do in responding to the needs and the questions of the families who lost family members in this, the answer to that question is very poorly.
That's correct. No, unlike the situation that exists today with respect to the families of the World Trade Center victims or the Pentagon victims, where they're being dealt with and by psychiatrists and others, the bodies of the families, the bodies of the victims of the Pan Am 103 passengers came back in forklifts at a warehouse. It was a very different era. But beyond that, it was a different era in terms of the government taking seriously the fight against terrorism. We had two American presidents who called the bombing an attack against America, but there was no effort at any military response. Clearly, we were less than vigilant in determining the nature of the terrorist threat, and it took September 11th to really issue that wake-up call. I'm reminded of the statement that President George W. Bush made in Atlanta on November 8th when he said, "We refuse to be in a state of denial." And I think what he was saying was that we refuse to remain in a state of denial because if not before, certainly after the bombing of Pan Am 103, we began to enter into the state of denial, deluding ourselves into thinking that the airlines were secure or that we were actually adopting meaningful policies to deal with international terrorism. Or that we could rely solely on the criminal justice system to bring perpetrators of terrorism to justice.
We'll try and get one more caller here. So someone on a car phone, line 4. Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
I was wondering if your guest could explain to the layperson why Libya would bother to defend themselves in American court, or ultimately, why would they even submit to a judgment?
Well, that's a good question, because two other states that were sued under the 96 Act, Iran and Cuba, didn't bother to appear in court, and as a consequence, what was called a default judgment were entered against them. Well, Libya had, number one, a strong economic motive. The UN Security Council found that Libya was responsible for the bombing, at least had believed that the evidence led to that conclusion, and imposed sanctions against Libya in 1991, and those sanctions cost Libya over the course of a decade, by its estimates, about $30 billion, by U.S. and World Bank estimates, something closer to $18 to $20 billion. So Libya had a financial incentive to get out of sanctions, and they realized that the only way that the sanctions regime, the only way that it would ever end, would be if the demands of the families and the demands of the U.N. Security Council resolutions that the families be compensated justly were met. So that provided an incentive. Beyond that, they had good reason to believe, it would seem to me, that with the aid of good lawyers and with the aid of this doctrine of sovereign immunity, they could actually go into court and win. So that's what they have done, and I think they've done it honorably. They've been in court for the last 9 years fighting us. I believe they have indicated in court at the very outset that they don't plan to make a charade out of the justice system, and that if they're in court, it means that if there is a judgment, that they will abide by the judgment. So I take them seriously at their word.
We are going to have to stop because we've used our time. We've just scratched the surface of the subject. So if people are interested, you should look at the book we've mentioned. It's titled The Price of Terror, Lessons of Lockerbie for a World on the Brink. It's published by HarperCollins, by Alan Gerson and Jerry Adler. Our guest, Alan Gerson, is Research Professor of International Relations at George Washington University. Professor Gerson, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it.